Hey everybody, it's Jason here. You might have noticed that it's anthology reissue season. Volumes 1, 2 and 3 are out again on vinyl and CD. A new volume 4 is appearing and the TV series is getting a spit and polish and is being reissued next week on streaming again with some bonus material. We thought at the Nothing Is Real offices that we should get into the spirit of things ourselves and have decided to reissue some bits and pieces from our back catalogue to celebrate Anthology Week. And we're going to start with this. It's an edit from our interview with Mark Lewison way back in October 2019. And he's talking to us here a little bit about what led him to working on the anthology. And we'll put out a few more bits and pieces next week. Enjoy! Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin. When we started the podcast, if you go back and listen to our introductory episode, we speculated from time to time we would have special guests. And we didn't realise back then that our first guest would be the one and only Mark Lewison. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
And welcome to the Nothing Is Real studio penthouse. If you're listening to this podcast, you already know who Mark Lewison is, I hope. But on the off chance you don't, he's the world's leading expert and historian about the Beatles, publishing his first book on the subject, The Beatles Live in 1986, and going up to his most recent publication in 2013, The Beatles, All These Years, Volume 1, Tune In. The first of a projected three-volume biography on the band.
So by 88, 89, where the EMI-Apple relationship has changed and Recording Sessions has just come out, and then your next step after Recording Sessions, is that when you begin an association with Apple directly at that point?
I began one with Paul first, because when The Beatles Live came out, he really liked that book. He really liked that book, and he and Ringo in particular would, a couple of the anecdotes in that book would become part of their storytelling. They loved the fact that that I reported that the Beatles had played a gig in Preston in September 63, and after the gig, Paul had driven off to judge a beauty contest. And if they ever knew that, I mean, Paul would have known it because he did it, but in the weight of everything else happening,
they get forgotten. These details get forgotten.
And suddenly he read that in the book and he loved it, and he and Ringo laughed about it, and they both mentioned that in interviews afterwards about judging a beauty contest and all that, and I knew they got that from the book, so that was very pleasing for me.
And you were telling me he signed a copy of the book for you.
He did, and honestly I can't remember what he wrote, but it was something like the best Beatle book ever. And signed it all the breast, Paul McCartney, and I think he actually put 10 out of 10 at the bottom as well, like a school teacher, which was nice. And then I interviewed him for the Recording Sessions book, and we got along very easily, and he enjoyed the questions being, you know,
a fantastic interview, I think. I remember my own, if I can be personal for a second, when I was 14 at Christmas 88, I had a voucher to spend after Christmas, and I bought the White Album and the Beatles Sessions book.
Right.
And that is basically, that has made all the difference. But I remember reading that interview at the time, and I think there's stuff in that interview that you just, he's talking in a way that you haven't really see. He's quite interested in technique and process.
He's very at ease. He's very at ease in that interview, I think.
Yeah, he was. Straight away, we actually did, because I'd met him once before, and because he had The Beatles Live, because I was writing the Sessions book, and I gave him a list of all the people I was interviewing, and they were all engineers and people like that at the studios that he had long relationships with and knew that they could be trusted. So he knew this book was going to be an okay book, because they took a very dim view of Beatle books after John died. Paul in particular took a very dim view. Post 81 really is when the Beatles literature explodes into what it became, and they were unhappy with a lot of those books.
The Peter Brown book was a big no-no, wasn't it?
It was for them.
Yeah.
It was for them, yeah. I mean, it educated a lot of other people, but for them, they had problems with that book.
Yeah.
And so when I was working with Paul, when I did that interview with him, he said, well, I actually had a call from his PA to say Paul is thinking of doing his autobiography and he wants to do it with you. So we'll put you under contract and we'll pay you, and you'll be available for Paul whenever he needs you. And I went, okay, fine.
Yeah, sounds like a good one.
Yeah, and I was very happy. I mean, I'd last been in regular employment in a paid job where someone gives you a paycheck and gives you salary and holiday pay and sick leave and so on 5 years earlier, and I was thinking I could probably eke 5 years out of my different ideas.
Yeah.
And suddenly it was opening up in front of me now. I could just carry on doing this.
So you're kind of on call then for interviewing and talking to Paul, or are you let loose on MPL archives, or what kind of happened?
No, I was just, when he was ready to do his book, I was lined up.
Oh, okay.
And then in the end, he never did that book.
Yes.
And I've said this in a couple of interviews elsewhere, so I won't go into too much into it, but I think I probably talked him out of it inadvertently. Because I was asked to put together a little briefing document about what his book should be.
Okay.
And I always aim very high. And I aim very high on his behalf, so that his book would be the very greatest of music autobiographies ever. It would absolutely set the benchmark.
Mm.
But obviously it would require time and effort to do that. And I think he probably just...
And is this the time when a Beatles biography starts germinating in your mind? Or is that still a few years away?
No, that was years away. The anthology came next.
Yeah.
After the settlement with EMI and Apple, with Apple now holding control over how things are going to be done, that's when Neil Aspinall started to evolve his Long and Winding Road film into the Beatles anthology. But the greatest impetus for the anthology was George's business problems.
Yes.
Because he was suddenly short of money, relatively so.
Yes.
In the early 90s, and needed a bit of Beatles income.
Yeah, so he was on the ropes because of Handmade Pictures and
Dennis O'Brien.
Dennis O'Brien.
Mm.
If I remember it rightly, what they did was they put out 62 to 66 on CD and 67 to 70, and then they did Live at the BBC, and then they did anthology.
Yeah.
And all those things, you see the return of the Apple logo on records, and the Apple logo returns onto the CDs that EMI put out in the 80s and all that kind of stuff. So
yes.
they're kind of building ahead of steam towards the anthology.
Yes.
I have very fond memories of the anthology because that was the one time I got to experience a new Beatles single, and I will defend Free as a Bird to the bitter end, and we've had long...
Jason is a big Jeff Lynne fan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so keen on the production sound on that single, but I actually prefer Real Love as a record, perhaps not as a song, but as I think it's closer to the...
Well, there's a new mix of Real Love that's appeared in the last two or three years, which is a... I don't know, I'm not exactly sure how it has come to supplant the other one, but it's an even better thing. It's a fantastic mix, that new version.
I don't know anything about why that was done, but I enjoyed that too.
And it done with very little fanfare.
Yeah.
I mean, just suddenly it appeared that it was there, and you suddenly hear something different, and you think, oh, they've actually changed.
Yes.
Changed it significantly, but no fanfare at all.
Yeah, I was really thrilled with both Free as a Bird and Real Love, personally. And but I know they're not... Jeff Lynne's production wasn't everyone's cup of tea on that. I mean, that drum sound in particular. But it's still the three of them. And they didn't spoil anything.
No.
Which was brilliant to actually achieve all that and not spoil anything. And from my own point of view, they had a little liner notes on the picture bags of those two singles. And they were by me.
Mm.
So it's the new Beatles single. And the last Beatles single that had come out, real Beatles single, was Let It Be.
Mm-hmm.
If you exclude reissues, which I was still at school, just started secondary school. And here's the next one. It's 25 years later and my name's on it. And I was very pleased about that.
I can imagine. Yeah.
I hadn't realized that. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the anthology for me was the high watermark of my years with Apple. Mm.
So the anthology grew out of this long and winding road that had, as I understand it, had initially, Neil Aspinall had started gathering stuff in the early 70s.
70.
And had been putting a warehouse together of clips and securing rights and seeing what was out there and getting best processes.
Mm. With their complete approval. I mean, it was an Apple project that just never happened. In the Beatles' time, it was 1970.
Is there a version of The Long and Winding Road somewhere in a vault? Like, is there an edit?
Yes, well, even better, it's circulating unofficially.
I haven't seen it, but I know it's circulating.
Oh, there is, I don't maintain in my head the names of all the bootleg labels, but there is a bootleg DVD label that put it out about 3 years ago.
Oh, I didn't.
You can buy it down the marketplace.
Did you see it on as a bootleg, or did you see it prior to as part of the anthology?
I saw it. I actually watched it with Neil Aspinall in Apple in 1991, and we just watched it on a little screen. It was Jeff Wonfer, who would go on to direct the Beatles anthology.
Yeah.
a lovely woman called Nell Burley, who was at Apple, who was at the start of the anthology but didn't live to see it through, Neil and me, and we watched it at Apple, and I made notes of the entire content of it, and Neil looked at me and went, "What are you making those notes for?" And I just need to record what I'm seeing here. All right, what are you going to do with that? Nothing. Don't worry. Just to have it.
Yeah. And that presumably is the version that Harrison would have shown to Eric Idle.
Yes.
I know you're a Ruddles fan.
Big, yes. Big.
So are we.
Yes. Yes.
Big Ruddles fan.
Yes.
But was that a specific screening that George arranged that specifically? And
yes, it may have only just been in an office somewhere, but Eric Idle definitely did see Neil's Long and Winding Road in its early edit form.
And can you tell, having seen them both, the Ruddles film, you can see the parallels where he's just lifting?
Yes, yeah, the classic Beatle film clips, like from the Merseysound film of Ringo, you know, walking through the hairdressing salon, which becomes Barry walking through the salon in Redditch. Yes, of course, that came from Eric seeing that.
And would George, Ringo, John, Paul, would they have been seeing rough cuts as that was being developed, do you think? Or
I don't know.
It was just a general sort of imprimatur to Neil Aspinall, you do this and you...
I don't actually know in the end why it stalled, because he was certainly working on it. It was Neil's focused project for at least a year, and there were people working on clearing rights and bringing footage in. So a lot of work was done, but Apple in the early 70s was probably a very difficult place to get things through because of Alan Klein, and because it's got four owners, but one of them is disagreeing with the other three quite fundamentally on everything. So, it just kind of fell in between the cracks. But the anthology was a brilliant project, and in every way, I think.
And so when you're getting from 91 to 95 when it comes out, I know Jeff Onefour, I think he had done the Flowers in the Dirt documentary with Paul.
Yeah.
And so he had been brought in to do his piece. And then, it's after that that there's interviews going on and Jules Holland is brought in and all these other pieces.
As I remember it, the first anthology interviews with the Beatles were from 92.
Okay.
And I would love to have been involved in those, but I wasn't. And that was principally because George said he didn't want me to do it. So they had Jules. Not that I would have necessarily been very good at it anyway at that time.
But yeah.
Jules Holland did some. I'm not sure I don't think he did them all, because Bob Smeaton.
I think he did the
most
first
of them.
Raft, and then the whole anthology. I mean, I suppose, like every Beatle fan, I adored the anthology project when it came out. But with hindsight, you can see the compromises between the principals.
Yes.
So it's Jeff Onefour is Paul's man. Jeff Lynne is George's man. Jeff Emmerich is Paul's man. And you can see them trading. It's almost like children in a playground picking members of a team.
Exactly that. I'll have him
and you can have...
Yeah, I was Paul's pick.
Yeah.
And I wasn't George's pick.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you don't necessarily end up with the best team.
No.
You end up with a compromise team, and then that sort of possibly feeds through into a compromise project. Anthology, I think, is excellent. But again, partly because of Tune In, you look at it and you think, I want to see more of that, or I want to know more detail about that, or I want that interview to be a little longer or a little deeper. But I just think that the politics fascinates me almost as much as the music. We were having this conversation beforehand about what it says about their personal relationships, and I just think the anthology is a very good example of that trade-off, that compromise. I don't know if Ringo really has any his people involved in that. Obviously it was Paul and George at that point.
I mean, Ringo had to be happy with the choices, and I think they all knew Jeff Onefour. I don't think it was just Paul, but he probably was Paul's pick, probably. There was a man called Rick Ward who did the design for the anthology, including the albums and CDs and DVDs eventually, and that he was George's pick. So yeah, there were... It was, I'll have him, so I'll have him. And I know that George didn't want me on it and argued with Paul about it, and didn't want Jeff Emmerich either, but that was another one that Paul pushed through.
Well, I can understand the Jeff Emmerich Having read Jeff Emmerich's book, I could understand why George wouldn't. I mean, I was...
Well, Jeff wasn't so anti-George in those days, but it was because he was on the receiving end of a lot of fairly strong assaults, verbal assaults from George, that he hit back in his book.
Okay.
Oh, right. Okay.
It started with George, that one.
During the anthology project? Or
Earlier.
Earlier?
Earlier, okay. Yeah. And I mean, I once heard George Harrison really ripping into Jeff Emmerich at George Martin's house to George Martin, and George Martin was going, "Oh no, you got it all wrong about Jeff. Jeff's not like that, you know." But George he was unshiftable in his opinions. George, unshiftable, and one of them was me,
yes,
and another one was Jeff Emmerich, and they were based on little or nothing,
yeah.
But they were there, and they could not.
They
be
weren't
going
to shift. No.
And the anthology sort of has that. Once again, Beatles' happy accident of timing, that it comes out at the right time. There's a revival in British music, Britpop at the time. It's still this. When I saw that bounty of stuff coming through on the telly, it's like, well, there was no YouTube. It was just the right time to see all of that stuff. 10 years later would have been too late.
Yes.
And it was perfect timing to get that out. In the production of it, I'm always fascinated by the moments when the three of them are together.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any experience of being in the same space with the three of them at any point in time?
No. They were closed sessions, and I certainly wasn't welcome. Even though I was well on the team, I was involved in all aspects of the anthology, but, you know, you still get shut out of the door at certain occasions.
Do you find... I find those bits fascinating to watch with the three of them, particularly when they're... You know that scene where they're sitting in George's garden and Ringo says, "I love hanging out with you guys." Mm. That bit... gets me in the throat, because I think Ringo is particularly earnest, and they're trying to be together, and there's certain stuff they just can't get over, it seems. I don't know, do you feel that, or do you notice that at that time when you'd see the footage of the three of them?
Yeah, I do. And George and Paul, there's an issue between them, unquestionably, through all the times that they're filmed together for the anthology, and I know that they were arguing as well on those days, or having strong disagreements, but I wasn't present, so I don't really know. But
there's another very strange...
It was necessary that they had to do the anthology. They did have to do it.
Well, again, and this idea of compromise.
Yes.
They each had... George, it was financial, perhaps. Paul...
Mm. Paul loves legacy.
It's a legacy thing, a reclaiming...
Yeah,
something perhaps. So they each had, for their own reasons, had to compromise.
They did, and yes, yeah. I know. One of my favourite memories of the anthology is Paul used to hold Buddy Holly Week parties in London every September, usually on the 7th, which was Buddy's date of birth. And when would this be? 95, probably 95, with the anthology just weeks away, because didn't it debut on television in November?
Yeah.
I think it was November 95, 20th maybe, in my head. And so by September 95, it's almost put to bed by this point. It's right on deadline, and they're kind of, it's just finishing off. And I wasn't... there had been a day, the previous day, Paul and George and Ringo had all been in the anthology edit suite, which was in London West 12 in a little rented place in Wendell Road. And they'd been going through, I think, the final episode, which obviously covered the more difficult part, the breakup. And it dredged everything up for them, because Paul was now seeing what George said about it, and George was now seeing what Paul said about it, and they're both seeing what Ringo said about it, and so on. And that was the day before the Buddy Holly Week party. And at the Buddy Holly Week party, all the anthology production team were there, and I was sitting with them, because we were working together all the time. So I was at the party through Paul's office, but we sat together. And because I was sitting with the anthology team, Paul came over and talked to them. He wasn't talking to me, but I'm just sitting there, and he's reflecting on how it had been the day before, watching the rough cut with George and Ringo, and obviously it had been really tough. And he was emoting to them about, wow, what a really tough day that was yesterday, and bloody hell, God, you know, there were bits that I didn't think we'd get through it, and all the stuff that had obviously come up in conversation that had been private to that room, and I wasn't present. But I was there when he was reflecting on it the next day with the team. And, God, that was a great moment for me. just to witness Paul saying all that to them.
Yes.
I just happened to be there when he said it.
But as I get older, I realize they're human beings. Like when I was younger, I was like, oh, why can't they just get on? But you just realize when you get older, people fall apart and it's hard to get over stuff, even with the best will in the world, you know?
I think that it seems to me that, I mean, we were all aware through the 70s and the 80s and probably into the early 90s when they were disagreeing with one another. You would get Paul disagreeing with Yoko quite openly and her disagreeing with Paul quite openly. And George and Paul obviously had some issues that did come out because we know about them. But it also seems to me that probably from the late 90s, maybe for about the last 20 years, they must have actually had they've got a policy now that they keep it all private. Because we don't know any of that stuff anymore. We don't know what Paul thinks of Yoko now or vice versa. Mm. They've obviously made an agreement to keep it quiet. And I think from their point of view, that's quite sensible.
Mm. And this is Apple really actively curating the legacy. Mm. And I suppose one of the things for me is it simply curating the legacy or is it rewriting history a little bit? And I suppose that's maybe what we're hoping volumes 2 and 3 are going to give us that insight. But after Anthology, then at what point does it start to tip into in your mind? It's a biography. I can build on the research that
there is the issue. I don't want to. I know you've spoken a lot in the past about how George was the main impetus for you to be pushed away from the Beatles organization. Is that's a fair thing to say?
George and then Olivia.
But you're still working with Paul because you're involved in Flaming Pie and.
Well, I was working for Paul. I was editing Club Sandwich for Paul.
Yes.
From 91 to 98.
Yes.
And Flaming Pie fell in that period. Mm. And he basically used the Anthology team going forward. I mean, it was still Jeff Wonfer. There was an interview with Paul done for the World Tonight documentary that's me and Jeff Baker interviewing Paul.
Yeah.
You just see the backs of our shoulders. You don't see our faces, but that's us. And and he had Rick Ward of the team do the artwork for it. So like a continuation of the Anthology, really. And because I'd done the liner notes on the Anthology CDs, so I did them for Flaming Pie.
That's what
as
I
well.
Was thinking of, yeah, that you're still writing for Paul and you're still in his sleeve notes.
Yes, I was. And went to a session or two and a video shoot or two.
Well, Mark, we cannot thank you enough for coming in and talking to us today.
Go on, try.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's been absolutely illuminating. And I think on behalf of all fans, we're very lucky to have you. Thank you for everything that you've done over the years. You know, when we started this podcast, we talked about how it's not just fun listening to the Beatles. It's fun reading about the Beatles, finding out about the Beatles, going deeper and deeper all the time. You know, I think when we started doing this podcast, we wondered, would we start hating the Beatles? And we don't. It just gets deeper and deeper and you go on and on and on. And it's fascinating.
You can only hate the Beatles if you've got hate in your hearts.
That's a very nice way of putting it. I think you're right. Mm. And so on behalf of all the fans, thank you. And thank you for coming in to talk to us today. And we hope you'll be back in Dublin very, very soon.
I will. I'm sure I will. Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, yes, we thank Mark Lewson for coming in to join us today. And that was a fascinating conversation, Stephen, wouldn't you say?
Yes. I never thought we'd have access to Mark Lewson. But yes, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
We remain online in the normal places. If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter at BeatlesPod. We're on Facebook. Look for the Nothing Is Real Facebook group and Stephen will let you join. Please leave all your regular reviews and 5-star exclamation points in whatever podcast app that you're using at the minute. But for Nothing Is Real, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we will see you next time. Thanks very much.